Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us. It is Thursday, the 21st of March, and it's a busy day. We got a lot going on, and we have a wonderful panel to talk about the stuff that is happening in our world, and I can think of no better word that at least I can say on the radio than stuff. So we welcome you to join us. It's panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we will welcome your letters. We always love to hear from you about a variety of things. Okay, so let me introduce the panel to you. We have Robert Griffin here. He is founding dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity of the University of Albany. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to have you aboard. We also welcome Jim Henler, Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI. Good morning and welcome back.
Good morning.
Nice to have you. We also welcome Teresa Bourgeois, Communications Consultant. Hello, Teresa. Great
hello,
to have you.
Hello. Delighted to be here on this second or first full day of spring.
First full day of spring. And Siena College Professor of Comparative Politics, Vera Carius Kelly, is here. Good morning, Vera.
Good morning. Great to be back.
Excellent. Good to have you back. And WAMC's Alan Chartok joins us as well. Good morning, Alan.
I'm big and I'm easy, and I'm here.
Okay. Do you want to explain that or just want me to keep going?
No. You know, we have a grandchild in New Orleans, and that's where we are with our wonderful son and grandchild. I've spent the whole morning making sure that the house is secure. We have somebody staying there, big dogs with them. We have a televised system so that anybody who came near the house, just to you know, set things straight, if you know what I mean.
I do indeed. Well, good morning and welcome. And it's nice to have you aboard. So we have a great group and we welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. All right. Well, you know, I was going to start with the McCain story, and then I know it's a story, and we're going to discuss it, I promise you, but I would like to start with Brexit because it just seems like it is so much more important a story because it seems like Europe is falling apart. So, the Brexit mess gets messier as the deadline nears. Where we are right now, for more than 2 years, British Prime Minister Theresa May has been looking for a pair of exit ramps, one to successfully navigate her country out of the European Union, as called for by voters in a 2016 referendum, and another to avoid further damage to her deeply divided Conservative Party. The coming days will determine whether the damage to herself is irreparable. The Prime Minister was dealt a terrible hand by her predecessor, David Cameron. It was Cameron's decision to call the Brexit referendum in the first place, hoping and perhaps believing that it would once and for all quiet the anti-Europe wing of his party. It proved a spectacularly failed gamble. Unexpectedly, the referendum measure narrowly passed, a crushing blow to a political establishment that had lined up almost uniformly in favor of remaining. Then Donald Trump becomes president. Now we have a March 29 deadline for leaving the EU. Trump continues to undermine the already weakened prime minister as he wages his ongoing campaign against elites. So, I'm going to go to Vera first.
Okay.
What do you think?
Well, what I think is the UK might be falling apart, but I don't think Europe is, to be honest. This is a British situation, and I'm also not sure that it matters what Donald Trump says about Theresa May. This is an internal British matter. Clearly, Theresa May played a gamble. She's lost again. She has an incredible capacity to come back up and try a new approach and a new angle. Currently, she's negotiating with EU leaders for an extension to a hard Brexit, which, of course, is the deadline that's looming.
Right.
And she's trying to pressure members of British Parliament to actually finally, on a third vote, support her plan.
I'm sure everyone can do the math, but the deadline is a week from tomorrow.
Right.
Okay.
That is why she's looking for an extension.
Right. Get a little more time.
Get a little more time.
How do you react if I tell you that I feel a little bit sorry for her?
Oh, I don't.
Okay. All right.
I don't.
All right.
No, I mean, she really wanted to become prime minister knowing what kind of a situation she was walking into. She has gambled a number of times. So I'm not 100% sure that I feel terribly sorry for her. She's been clever in some ways, and she may still get her way.
Alan, what do you think?
Well, I don't know. I'm a great admirer of Vera. However, you know, our capacity should never be lost for feeling bad for somebody. I mean, I think she's tried everything she can. I think there's no way out. That's the problem. There is no way out. If there was a way out, they would have figured it out. Now, you do have Angela Merkel this morning or yesterday talking about how she's willing to give a little bit more time. And that's a bit of a budge. So what you don't want to do is get a situation here where, you know, they give them a year and then they give them another year. And then
well,
that
can't happen because this is the thing with the EU. They have European Union elections coming up.
Right.
The British cannot be voting. If they want to leave the European Union, they can't vote for a parliamentary position in the European Union. This is one of the sticking points. And the EU is simply saying, okay, so we'll give you a little bit of an extension possibly, although Macron is opposed to that. They have to unanimously support this. And in the UK, they're basically saying you can't vote a third time on the exact same plan. So,
okay, Vera, I defer to nobody in terms of my respect for how smart you are. So just give me one small little answer. What should she do now?
Resign.
Resign.
All right. So Jim has some thoughts.
Yes,
here as
I was
well.
Over in Spain last week, and I was at a conference. And we went to the speaker's dinner, and there were 12 of us around the table. I was the only one who wasn't from either the UK or the EU. So Brexit was the topic. So the one thing I'll say there is the Europeans are very worried about this because the interconnections between the countries and particularly between them and the UK is amazing. So the level of detail that we never hear about over on this side of the ocean, they were worried, you know, these are professors, so a lot of people worry about student exchanges, funding, all that. But also economics.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the things, the Fed chair was asked about Brexit this week, and, you know, one of his answers was, we shock test our banks just in case of things, but Brexit's so big we don't even know what will happen in the States. So
economically it's a terrible mess.
But also in terms of people movement. You know, what they're worried about is Britain leaving at a time where there's nationalist movements going on. The Netherlands just had some one of their movements move much higher up and did better than expected elections. Mm-hmm. So again, you know, EU has kept Europe out of war for many years now.
Right.
People are really worried that this is the start of a very scary time for them.
That's a really important question for people at home are listening and saying, how does Brexit affect me? You know, there's a whole issue of the Irish question and what happens between Ireland and North Ireland. There's a whole question of what happens to a weakened NATO at the same time we're seeing increased Russian aggression. And the whole issue of a much weaker European economy, which is going to continue to have ripple effects through both the Asian and our economy. So this is actually a big deal for us.
However, on a lighter note, one of the stories that everyone loved was France's EU minister has renamed her cat Brexit. Because she says, it keeps meowing loudly to go out the door, but when she opens it, it refuses to go out.
I mean, so you're absolutely right. So one of the options besides having the option to just step down and say, let somebody else try, is to, of course, call for a new election to get some clarity on who represents the British people. The second option is to reconsider a Brexit vote because people participated in this Brexit referendum without having full understanding and knowledge about what they were participating in and what the consequences might be. And of course, to attempt, you know, the third option, which is the least appealing option, is to attempt to get some modifications through to this May plan as long as the EU leadership negotiates with her a little bit longer.
Right. I mean, I think...
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Alan, you had asked, you know, what's the way out? And that's my question is out really the way? And the question, it seems that this is you know, the people thought they wanted a divorce and now they're rethinking it. And, you know, I think the Europeans don't want their divorce. And I don't think the U.S., despite what Donald Trump and Donald Trump Jr. have said, I don't think it's in the U.S. economic interest for this divorce. So the question is, what's the path to reconciliation? What's the process path, and how quickly can you get there? Because clearly they cannot find a route to divorce. And I agree with you, Robert. I looked at some of the USTR numbers about the U.S. British trade, and it's not insignificant, particularly around the agriculture. And it's going to have a severe economic impact. Now, Trump says, well, he'll work out a better deal directly with each of these countries. But that's not, you know, that's not necessarily the case. And I think we all need to be worried about the weakening of Europe.
Alan?
Well, yeah, I think, you know, Theresa's right, except for one small fact. They did vote, as I remember a week or so ago, about in Parliament about, you know, the concept of going to another election, and it went down. So once again, the door is shut.
So my British friend's comment on that was when you actually looked at what happened in that vote, it was exact party lines, and it was because nobody wants May's position.
Right.
If they vote against her and go to new elections, someone else is going to have to deal with this mess. So, in fact, one of the strongest things my British friends who are sort of doing British inside baseball, or I guess I should say inside cricket, really say is it's like, you know, the politics at the moment is so bizarre because essentially all the politicians would like to keep May as the person who's going to get blamed for everything.
She has her job because no one wants it. I mean, I'd be interested in our listeners. No doubt we have listeners who are from Ireland or Scotland or, you know, other places. You know, what are they thinking? What's their view on this?
It is. Given that you only, we only have a week, I mean, to Alan's point, I mean, so who makes the next move now? There's really no, we have no sense as to where we're headed on this.
Oh, well, we have a sense. I think Theresa May is desperately trying to get some kind of an agreement from the, she's begging the EU again for some kind of a extension.
Will they budge?
She can only get it. They will be giving her a little bit of an extension, I think.
Yeah.
And then she has to make some slight modifications to her plan to be able to vote on it for a third time. Her gamble is that members of parliament will realize this is the last time around. If nobody wants to vote in support of this plan, then she will have to either call for new elections, step down, or the referendum has to be put in front of the British people once again. Now, a lot of nervousness exists around those other options. So she is gambling that the third time around is the charm. My forecast, you're looking at me?
Yes.
No.
and the gamble won't pay off.
It's hard to tell.
Well, what I'm looking at is from the panel, other people on the panel, that has stumped me, of course, is what to do. I mean, we can all talk about May as a failure, in this situation or that, and nobody wants the job. There's always, by the way, somebody who wants the job. But what is the way out? I don't get it. I don't think there is a contemporary way out until the pain gets worse.
Well, the pain is getting worse because you already know, for example, that because of all the hostility towards foreign workers in the UK, we have a dramatic shortage of truck drivers. They used to be mostly Slovenian and Polish, and those people have mostly left the UK because they felt there was no future for them. And Poles, for example, were targeted in violent nationalistic attacks in the UK. So a lot of these people have left. The jobs are open. Transportation is already becoming a challenge, transportation of products throughout the UK. If you hire local workers, if you can find local British truck drivers, they cost twice as much. And so the product prices are rising. Economically, the UK internally is already feeling some pressure because, for example, health professionals have left the UK in large numbers and they had to bring in workers from the Philippines, nurses and physicians and so on. So the sort of, you know, focus on domestic British development and nationalistic ideals are completely undercut by the fact that you don't have enough qualified British labor in all these different sectors, and you will have to hire international workers. Now, if you leave a union like the European Union or a trade pact, that also becomes more challenging. So this is really counterproductive in terms of the original ideas that were discussed with the Brexit referendum. So this is a really interesting scenario where one can only hope that MPs begin to reflect on what a hard Brexit could mean, i.e. leaving the European Union without an agreement, and the devastation, the economic and social devastation the UK will face primarily, but also the ripple effects on our economies.
Can I ask a question, which is this? Is there any relationship between Donald Trump and Make America Great Again and Brexit, which is we want it the old way?
Well, there's one real connection, which was they were both mightily manipulated by the Russian social media activities.
And also
Brexit taking place first.
Steve Bannon involved and with UKIP. Was it Nigel Farage? Am I saying his name correctly? Right, in terms of pushing this agenda, as well as in France, pushing this far right agenda. But the question is, if the EU does not want them to leave, I don't know if that's true, but say it is, do they try to help her find a path back to not leaving?
Well, no, the European Union is not going to help them find a path for the simple reason because they don't want anybody else to leave. They want it to be as painful as possible for the UK.
No, I said to not leave. Their interest is to have them not leave. So would they, it seems like she's trying to push up against the deadline and force them to take decisions that they don't want to take. But conversely, if she can't find a path, are they doing anything to try to help her not leave?
We're going to leave with that question. We'll come back with an answer, perhaps, or at least thoughts. We have a great panel. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. panel@wamc.org. Alan Chartok is here. Vera Karius-Kelly, Robert Griffin, Jim Hendler, and Teresa Bourgeois. We will continue with our conversation. And again, your letters right after this short break.
Meet you downstairs in the bar and heart. Your rolled up sleeves and your skull t-shirt. I say, what did you do with him today? And sniff me out like I was Tanqueray. Cause you're my fella, my guy.
Spanglish Fly is providing the music for us this morning. They are playing at Mass Mocha in North Adams on Saturday. MassMocha.org for more information. You can find the whole playlist and all the cool songs that we're playing this morning at WAMC.org/roundtable. Okay. Anything else anybody wanted to say before we go on to the letters about this?
Yeah, I just wanted to say that Theresa May is begging for assistance, and she's pretty much gotten everything she's going to get from the EU. The EU is very committed to to having Ireland and the Northern Irish issue resolved rather than reigniting a violent conflict. So this is where it's at. I think she either has to find some kind of wiggle room to convince her members of parliament, or it's going to be a hard Brexit.
We just need Vera, to hope they find a way to remain. I think that's the key.
Alan? That's not going to happen.
So Vera, are you predicting that if it all gets screwed up, that the Irish thing will reignite?
There's a high likelihood for that. Everybody's deeply concerned about a return to violence. You already saw some Irish Republican Army activities. I mean, they're reorganizing at this moment because they feel profoundly threatened by this Brexit situation.
Yeah, and there's also an interesting other twist to this that, Scotland actually benefits from being in the EU. Yeah. And they've come very close a couple times to voting themselves out of the United Kingdom. And I think that with a hard Brexit that disadvantages Scotland, you're seeing a complete potential breakdown of the United Kingdom as we have known in our lifetime.
I agree.
We have these wonderful people on the panel this morning who know about international relations far better than I do. So let me ask you a question. It seems to me it was always the question of Catholicism versus Protestantism, and the Catholics felt oppressed, and that was going on. So that was resolved. But why? My naivete is I don't understand why the hard border will reignite what was a passionate fight over religion.
So if I could jump in, I would argue that the sectarian disagreements has not been resolved. I think it's been taken off the front heat, but even just a little bit more heat there is going to bring back a lot of those simmering resentments. The idea of British manned armed border guards between North Ireland and the rest of Ireland brings back real memories of the Troubles, and it will be viewed by many as setting the clock back more than 20 years, and it will be an embodiment of all of the wrongs that have occurred over time. And for folks that want to stir trouble, it will give them the perfect catalyst to do that.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. And the other thing is also we have to remember that we have deep ethnic division, not just religious. It is predominantly the English countryside that voted in favor of Brexit, whereas Irish Catholics, Scottish, have voted in favor of remaining. So we have a division along not just religious, but we also have class and ethnic lines. And this can easily be used to mobilize multitudes of referenda in various parts sort of separate from English domination, and it brings back sort of these neo-colonial notions from the past. So this is a very dangerous step, and I think we're all in agreement that we will likely see, if the hard Brexit takes place and we see economic suffering because of it, which is likely, then we are probably seeing a rise in ethnic and religiously motivated violence.
Joe, it would be great, and I know nobody can do this better than you, if we could get a hold of Richie Neal, who, of course, was one of the guys who brought this whole thing to an end, and he gets great credit for it, and a real expert on this. And maybe we could get him on the panel, or at least a news story from him, because he'll be the guy who tells us what his perspective is.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We have a lot of letters. We'll wade through as many as we can here before we have to go to a break. Michael writes to us, "I'm not Scottish or Irish, but as a Ukrainian American, I have no doubt that Putin had and still has his grimy little fingers in the Brexit fiasco."
Yes.
Joe writes, "Are you aware that reports say that the only way an extension can happen is with the unanimous consent of all the countries in the EU?" Uh-huh. Nigel Farage is lobbying the right-wing leaning governments, including Italy, to vote against the extension. Any comments on that?
So that was one of the things that was discussed at the dinner. Mm-hmm. The current...
The hell of a dinner.
Yeah. The current... Well, it was Spanish dinner, so we started early about 9 o'clock at night and went into 1 in the morning. And,
a lot discussed.
I would love to have been at that dinner just listening.
But... There's a couple things that are odd. One is pretty much all of the Brits agree that if there was a new vote, they have no idea how it would turn out, but probably would be the same.
Really?
So even the Remainers say they'd be nervous about a new vote. And then, I think all these things about the tension stuff, it was really an interesting conversation. But what I think is going to happen, according to the rumors at the moment, is EU will probably give them a short extension. At the moment, May 22nd has been put on the table. I don't know why that's significant. And that's mostly because it forces them to make a decision before the elections.
We got this letter from Scott. This is my opinion, and to keep it brief, this is an example of what sort of damage can be done when elite/wealthy leave us behind, the rest of us. In other words, it's in their interest to bring everyone along in the success. Here it has played out with the election of Donald Trump. Average folks say, why not overturn the apple cart? I'm not getting any apples anyway.
Well, I mean, that's a general attitude. You know, I agree. I think you find that in the UK and as well as here. You know, where are my apples, basically, before? And I mean, right now they're still waiting for the apples to fall. I'm not sure they're ever going to drop from the tree.
Joanne steps in and says, as an expat, I agree that there should be another vote by the public. Jamie says, you keep addressing the Brexit issue as if it's an economic one, when in fact it's a strictly a racial issue. The British have that distinctive European-type racism called nationalism and patriotic desires. They do not want ambitious Polish workers as much as they do not want people who cook strange-smelling food. You cannot overcome this with economic rationality.
I certainly would say that a lot of my British friends only half joke when they call me a colonist.
But, you know, I wanted to point out one thing. When you ask British people what their favorite food is, at least in urban environments, they say tiki masala, right? And you're thinking, wait a minute, since when is that British food? But, you know, so it depends on where you look in the UK. I think it's actually very hard to make a consistent argument on that.
But if you look at the cities, you know, after mm-hmm. the World War, in order to repopulate, mm-hmm. they lost so much of their mm-hmm. population that they opened up the England for the rest of the Commonwealth right. countries. So if you go to places like Manchester and Liverpool and even sections of London, it's incredibly diverse and accepting communities. And that's that pressure between the urban areas that are incredibly mm-hmm. diverse and the rural areas that are much less diverse.
And if this sounds very familiar,
it is.
It is
exactly the same yep. that's playing out here.
Alan?
Exactly right.
You know, we could take this right back to the fight between Churchill and Roosevelt. Roosevelt thought, you know, that Churchill's insistence on colonies and on colonization and on the British way, which has just been described as nationalism, was intolerable, and he wasn't going to let it happen. And so Churchill, who started out the war as an equal partner, ended up as a third partner. And you see that this is in fact, reached right down to the present time.
We got this letter from Julie, who writes, to me, the lesson of inane, simplistic Brexit vote is this: beware the nationalist movement that invariably leads to confusion, chaos, and fear associated with the false thinking your country is better off going it alone in the world. Newsflash, it's not. My hope is most Brits have learned their lesson, as Americans are with our awful America First president. National hubris just isn't worth it. Rick writes, hi, panel. This country also needs truck drivers, and we soon will be in the same position as the UK.
Well, we may be. That is correct.
Especially if you look at birth rates, right? I mean, if you look at sort of those key demographics mm-hmm. to what the nation used to be strong, this is part of the conversation that's being left out of the immigration debate here, is that we need an infusion of new and younger workers into the workplace. Or we're going to be looking at what Japan looks like.
Mm-hmm.
Bob writes, please clarify, are there any good faith Brexiter politicians? It doesn't seem like anybody is still saying that leaving the EU will lead to positive results. So why are so many MPs still for it?
So, I would ask you, you know, again, we can use an American analogy, just the politics. Right. You know, there's party politics at play here. But I'm not sure. I mean, I certainly know enough people sort of so my age demographic, sort of the 60s educated, is like the most split demographic on the Brexit stuff. So I've been hearing a lot from both sides. But it's really unclear. There are a lot of people who think going it alone will bring us back to the good old days of Britain. And these are people who are smart people who kind of have a meaning to that that's different than just a nationalist meaning. They really think there was a much more self-sufficiency. They really felt that the country was more able to plot its own course, that they were leaders in certain kinds of innovation, and that they've lost some of that. I don't know that I agree with them, but at least there certainly are people who are in good faith pro-Brexit.
Mm-hmm.
We got this letter from Maggie, who says, I am a Scot, have lived in the U.S. for just over 30 years and agree completely with Vera's regards to Theresa May. I have no sympathy for her as she knew what she was getting herself into. Scotland, like Northern Ireland, voted to remain, so you can imagine how many of the Scots and Northern Irish feel. When David Cameron realized his massive blunder, he washed his hands of the whole mess and walked away. And why May thought she would be able to achieve the impossible, Lord only knows. The whole thing is a total shambles.
The only thing I'd correct is I don't think he walked away. I think he ran away.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, and May is so stuck holding the bag.
Alan? He really messed up. He really messed up. You're quite right. So the question then becomes, why? He thought he would win, right?
I mean, yeah, right. He thought he could win.
So self-confident, it was unbelievable.
And one more letter, and then we'll go to break, and then we'll come back, and we have many more letters. But Tom writes, the main reason England wants to stay in partnership with Scotland is because Scotland has the North Sea oil. In a few years' time, England will also be short of water, and we have that as well. That from Tom in Connecticut.
But we'll see if the Scottish feel like sharing all their resources with a place that doesn't agree with the predominant opinion in Scotland. So this is going to heat up.
It's an excellent point, though, about the natural resources that will get divided should UK break up.
Mm-hmm. All right, panel, let us take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have many more letters. We have lots more to say on this issue as well as tackle other issues as well. We welcome your thoughts. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel this morning. Alan Chartok, Teresa Bourgeois, Jim Hendler, Robert Griffin, we can call him Bobby, said, and Vera Karius-Kelly. We're thrilled to have our wonderful panel. We welcome you as well. Panel at WAMC.org. Two letters on a similar vein, and then I'll throw it over to Teresa for a little explanation. Had it not been for Mercer money funding Cambridge Analytica with Steve Bannon pushing Nigel Farage and Boris Johnson, I believe Brexit would never have happened. Then Adriana says, Facebook broke the law, Cambridge Analytica broke the law, Vote Leave broke the law, Leave EU broke the law, Brexit and Trump both won through breaking the law. Facebook let it all happen and covered it up. So when it comes to Cambridge Analytica and the Mercer money, what do you make of that?
So obviously Cambridge Analytica had a major role to play in the U.S. election in their targeting. And I'm not an expert in what they did with Brexit, but I've read that they were deeply involved in that as well, targeting, bringing people out, discouraging other people from voting. And I think that a lot more light needs to be shown on the impact of Cambridge Analytica on the U.S. election and on the Brexit question, you know, all driven by the Mercer money. And the question, you know, people have stopped focusing on Mercer, but what I've wondered all along is, what did he want in all of the investments that he made? And did he get a payoff in all of the investments that he made? Because remember, he brought us Steve Bannon and Kellyanne Conway and a lot of other cast of characters that surrounded Trump and helped him win. And what did he get for that? What did he want? What did he get?
We got this letter from Ken from Tilson, who writes, the press is the enemy of the people, public servants populate a dark state intent upon taking down the current president. There is an invasion at the border that constitutes a national emergency, and opposition party members are socialists. Normal standards of civility are continually lowered until it's acceptable to malign a deceased national hero. Does this sound like the marketing campaign of a wannabe dictator?
Everybody's looking at me.
Yeah.
And
we're all looking at each other. Yeah,
yeah, I think we're all.
Well, I think no one wants to say yes.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think we do certainly, you know, as we've been saying for a couple of years, live in troubling times. And the question, fundamental question, is for the Republicans, particularly the Republicans in the Senate, is what kind of country, you know, what do you want your legacy to be? Are there any important norms anymore? And how do you feel about the fundamentals of democracy? And at some point, we know what Trump's approach is. At some point, the Republican leadership has to decide, you know, are they going to step up or not?
Yeah, and in all this conversation, even with the Brexit conversation, the main message I think that we need to remember is that elections matter.
Right.
And you can't sleep on any single election, and that's what happened. You know, they slept on the Brexit election, they slept on presidential elections, we slept on congressional elections. Elections matter, and if you don't go out and get counted, then bad things can absolutely happen to you. To answer your other question from your earlier statement, what did they get? You know, the Mercers got a tax payoff that rivals any infusion of money that they could get any other way. If you think about what they got from the election, that, you know, when you weaken the EU, you weaken the I would say the most principled regulatory body in the world. If you start to think about what the EU has been doing as far as the ecology and societal changes, their regulatory powers are growing, but they're antithesis to what the Mercers believe in. So the idea of weakening the EU further helps their position. They got an awful lot out of both the Trump election and the Brexit.
What I've been curious about, too, and Don Jr.'s engagement in the Brexit issue with his op-ed the other day.
When you care enough to send the very best.
Right. But that must be driven by Trump business economic interests. And I know they have business in Scotland and other places. But I wonder, you know, what is their economic calculation there that has them intervening so loudly?
Because do you remember when Trump went on his first journey to meet economic ministers and prime ministers in Europe, and he tried to have one-on-one economic negotiations with Belgium and Germany, and then he was reminded that you can't have a deal cut with just one country. It's a trading bloc. And I think that really bothered him because he prefers one-on-one deals, you know, like real estate deals that he picks on a country that offers an opportunity for him. And that's how he pushes for what he perceives is a good deal for the United States.
From the Washington.
I would just point out that a weakened EU makes Deutsche Bank a little bit stronger. Now, I'm not going to go into any kind of conspiracy theory.
Bringing us back to yesterday's story.
And on the issue of voting, today is the anniversary of the first march from Selma to Montgomery, which was at its core, you know, really over time brought us the Voting Rights Act. And I think that that is, you know, this issue of voting is so fundamental, and elections matter is so fundamental.
From the Washington Post, into all this confusion heavily, President Trump and his eldest son, Donald Trump Jr., though in ways that only add to the muddle. The president last week told reporters in an Oval Office photo op that he gave May advice long ago, and she ignored it. He claimed his advice would have led to a successful exit for Britain. She didn't listen to that, and that's fine, he said last week. His son published a far more incendiary opinion piece in Wednesday's editions of The Telegraph. The article was a battle cry on behalf of the forces that elected his father and upended Britain with the Brexit referendum. He disparaged Theresa May for ignoring his father's advice. May has said Trump told her to sue the EU, and called on her to live up to the results of the referendum and take Britain out of the EU quickly, while warning that a reckoning is coming on both sides of the Atlantic.
Well, I just love the fact that, you know, Trump and son believe that they can actually offer useful advice to a European experienced politician. Now, I obviously don't agree with everything Theresa May did, but she's a heck of a lot more politically, you know, astute, let's say, than our current leadership, who just don't seem to understand the most basic concepts about how the EU works and the British political system and structure is organized.
I would love to see both Trump or Trump Jr. have to sit through the prime minister questioning that.
Yes,
would be must-watch TV. she's a much more astute politician than she's being given credit to.
Mm-hmm. And if
so, I think you have to.
Go ahead, Alan.
I'm sorry. So I think you have to assume for a second that when we say that he offered, that Trump offered advice, that he really was offering advice. I think he was offering dissonance, don't you?
Could be.
Well, it was a shove is what he's offering. But the question is, Alan, is that outside the norms, the boundaries of what foreign leaders do, or is that within? I mean, am I remembering correctly that President Obama did urge remain, right?
Yes, yeah, he did. And I mean, there's certain protocols that you always want to try to follow. I mean, the same way that we're trying to follow a position of make America great, she's trying to follow a position to make UK great. Right. So sometimes these interests are contrary to each other, and you need to be very careful about appearing as if you're just a pawn for another foreign government.
But the question is Donald Trump's urging the dissolution in the economic interest of the U.S., or is it in the economic interest of the Trump administration? Of the Trump family. That's what you have to keep asking. Is it a Trump family position, or is it a U.S. position?
And this is the problem all the way through, is that I can't disconnect in my mind where the national interests are now blending in with the Trump business interests. Yep. And that's particularly true when any time I hear Junior talk, is that I really think he's representing the best interests of the business. And what he's trying to make sure that everybody understands, that any favor that the dad does on behalf of the American people should be reflected in some quid pro quo for the business. Mm-hmm. That's where this emolition clause becomes so important.
Yeah. I'm no expert, but it just seems from what I read, and you two are much more expert in Jim than I am, but that the U.S. economic interest is a stronger, more, whole Europe, EU, and that certainly our national security interest is that.
Well, it's been completely, our national security interest has been undermined. Our relationship with the UK is by no means as strong as it once used to be. Intelligence units are still collaborating, of course, but there is a sense of distrust, because one never knows what a member of the Trump administration all of a sudden releases to the media, or how they frame an issue, or what kind of statements are made. So we used to be very close allies militarily and in terms of intelligence work. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I think we're at a new low at this point.
I think there's an awful lot of tension in a relationship that was as close as it could possibly be.
And doesn't that, just like the McCain problem, come back to the dossier with Trump? I mean, because he sees the Brits.
Yeah, the Steele dossier.
He sees that coming from the Brits. Mm-hmm.
I think it's just another element of it. I actually think that there's more to play with UKIP and a broader politically philosophical position pushing towards the right, and business interests as well, that I think play a role.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we will continue our conversation. We'll move on to some other topics. And we will be ready for that. Panel at WAMC.org if you would like to join in on the conversation. Panel at WAMC.org. Ray Graff with news right after this. Spanglish Fly has the panel dancing this morning. That's good. And Rich isn't even here. Spanglish Fly playing Mass Mocha on Saturday. MassMocha.org for more information. Jim Hendler, I turn the microphone over to you for a quick shout out.
I just wanted to say happy birthday to my wife, if she's listening.
Oh, very nice.
Happy birthday to you.
Very nice. Vera, you have an upcoming gig you'd like to tell us about.
Yes, so I am opening up the Underground Railroad History Conference called Liberty Conference 2019, Seeking Sanctuary. I'm giving the opening address on 329 at Siena College, Shaping Inclusive Communities, Solidarity in Times of Othering. And if you're interested in this weekend event, it starts March 29th, ends on the 31st. Look at www.undergroundrailroadhistory.org.
UndergroundRailroadHistory.org, and I'm sure we can have a link on our website for that as well. Congratulations. Very cool
Thank you.
All right. Let's move on to some other stuff. I want to real quick, I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on this, but just address it because everyone else in the world is addressing it. I feel like we have to at least talk about it, which is the story about John McCain and the Trump comments yesterday while he was speaking in Ohio. It was about 5 minutes of the address. For those of you who have seen it, I think it was disturbing on many levels. One of the things that came out of it, I thought, was it was interesting of how quiet the crowd got and how uncomfortable and awkward it got, which seemed to make the president even more uncomfortable and yet didn't shut him up, which I thought was interesting. And but the president was very focused on Senator John McCain, who has been dead for 7 months. His feud with him is very much alive, and in front of a military audience at a tank plant in Lima, Ohio, he took it to a new level. He said he gave Mr. McCain the funeral he wanted, and I didn't get thank you, exaggerating the role he played in honoring the senator's death 4 days before his 82nd birthday. He blamed him for a war in the Middle East that McCain pushed so hard. He said that McCain didn't get the job done for our great vets and the Department of Veterans Affairs, and he was blunt in saying that his animosity toward McCain was not going to change. I have to be honest, quote, I've never liked him much.
You know, I think it's the first true thing Trump has ever said.
This one really aggravated me. Trump going after someone who, whether you agreed with McCain's politics or not, served this country in both the military. He served his troops when by refusing to be released when he was a prisoner of war so he could stay with his troops. He served the country as a senator. And his comments are should be offensive to any vet, anybody who has served this country. And as angry as I am at the president and, frankly, the president's speechwriters for even allowing that in, I'm equally angry at people who should be supporting John McCain, like Lindsey Graham.
Yeah.
I mean, last time I saw Lindsey Graham's backbone, it was on a milk carton. I mean, where is he? This was one of his best friends who's being disparaged by a man who avoided service because of bone spurs. I mean, where is McCain? Where is the principled position from politicians on both sides of the aisle to say that enough is enough of this?
What's interesting, I mean, he's running for re-election in South Carolina, and apparently he's made the political calculus that he can't speak out against Trump and win his, because he'll be primaried. But South Carolina, there's a lot of military folks. My brother lives there. There's a lot of military folks in South Carolina that I bet are disgusted by this. And he gave such a mealy, response yesterday, so weak. But I also think that Senator McCain, when he was alive and Trump was attacking him, he would shift it to focus on public policy issues and not take the bait. And I think that that's what Dems need to do. I think Republicans need to step up. But I think, what is it that Donald Trump does not want us to talk about or focus on? He's trying to shift the conversation. He'd rather a conversation about him and McCain than a conversation about health care, than a conversation about bombing in civilians in Somalia, than a conversation about what's going on in the Midwest and how we're going to deal with the floods, or his failed trade negotiations with China that are devastating our farmers. So the best thing the Democrats could do is focus on the substance.
Alan?
Or he's trying to divert from the Mueller investigation, which I think is more likely, to be honest. I think the other part of this that is so disturbing is the idea of, how much are we looking at the mental health pathology that's involved in Trump at this stage of the game. And that's what's most disturbing to me, the idea that he would be this nutty about what he's saying just indicates that we got a guy with his finger on the button there who is in a position to destroy us all, who may really have serious, serious mental health problems.
Well, that's what Salter, McCain's top aide and co-author of his books and such, said today, is that we have to come to grips with the fact that the president, has serious issues and is unfit for office. But again, I think that the best response to this should be to hold him accountable on the public policy issues. I mean, this week, his administration announced that they want to cut funding for loans for higher education because they claim that will reduce college costs. I mean, that's insanity. And Alan, I absolutely agree with you that part of this is distracting against the Mueller issues. But I think that we need a national discussion on the policy implications of, you know, all our focus is on what this means in Trump's life. We need to understand of what the policies mean in the lives of the American people. Democrats need to get back to that conversation because that's how he's held accountable.
Well, while you're right, certainly on the issues, Teresa, I don't think that's what this is about. I think this is really about his personal survival politically. I don't think he cares about economic policy, and you're so right, in social policy. I just think this is all about him and his worries about being impeached.
Well, that I agree with you, Alan. That's what his worry is. But what I'm saying is the American public's worry is the policy implications that are the implications for the policies that are happening while he's drawing all the attention and all the attention is focused, you know, on his well-being, on his, you know, he's worried about his company's well-being. We need to be worried about the countries. We need to be worried about the farmers.
Do you think the Democrats are saying enough?
I think that the Democrats need to be more vocal on the implications of his public policies. And that is how you're going to sway those voters who are sticking with him. That people need to have a better understanding of the deep damage he's doing to our dairy farmers with his inability to reach a deal with China, to the, you know, why is there not dramatic attention on what's going on in the Midwest right now with flooding? Billions of dollars in damage to major thoroughfares that will move our, you know, our breadbasket, right? Roads are out, bridges are out. Why is there not intense focus on that? We're talking about John McCain and, you know, Donald Trump doesn't like John McCain when these folks are suffering in the Midwest in these devastating floods that are only going to get worse over the next few days. And the Democrats should be talking about that, and they should be holding the Republicans accountable for not standing up to Donald Trump on this.
Agreed, agreed. But, Teresa, my problem with this is that while you are absolutely right about everything you're saying about policy, economic policy, social policy, and you're right about others not stepping up and doing what's right, there is something in the American people that likes keeping it very simple politically. Pardon me. And that's what this, that's what's so disturbing, that they don't.
But, Alan, the Democrats were able to win on health care. I mean, the 2018 victory was not on impeachment. It was on health care. Right. And what Trump has been able to do since then is keep the conversation off of health care. At the same time, while he's distracting with all his crazy tweets on the anniversary of the first tweet today in 2006 was the first tweet. You know, while he's distracting, as I said, you know, his book was The Art of the Deal. It should have been The Art of the Distraction. While he's distracting, what, you know, his administration is weakening our health care system, right? Yeah. In ways that the American people voted against.
Well, you're right. The problem is that I don't think you're right about what the American people know. I don't know that you'll get universal acceptance, by the way, Teresa, on the idea of why he lost the election. Yeah, he was going to take something away that they had, very dangerous, and that they perceive that. So it may have been part of it. Not part of it was Hillary Clinton, and the idea that, you know, they wanted, there were people in this country desperate enough to want change and to make the mistake of listening to him, that he was a change agent and he was going to make things better for them, which he hasn't.
I meant the 2008, Alan, sorry, I meant the 2018. If I said 16, I meant 18 election, the congressional election. I apologize if I said.
I see.
But I think Alan has a point in terms of saying that a lot of Trump supporters simply are focused on the idea of Trump destroying Washington, D.C. the way they know it. And it is sort of perceived as this elitist-run, policy-wonky place that cares very little about the real lives of people in the Midwest or in the Deep South or, you know, in the center of the country. And even though you're absolutely right to point out to the floods and all the destruction, but there's still a lot of people who are simply focused and distracted by Trump, by this promise of just destroying the old Washington, D.C., draining the swamp or whatever you want to call it. And that is what they're so focused on, and they still believe in that.
But it's his rhetoric and his actions are two completely opposite things, and that's what he has to be held accountable for.
Jim?
Okay. I was just agreeing.
All right. Agreeing is fine. I'm going to go to a couple letters, and then I want to move on to our final subject for this morning. Christopher writes, if things are truly bad and Trump is truly exhibiting dangerous behavior, we can't afford to wait for the Republicans to act. We can criticize the GOP for putting short-term political expediency over the good of the country, but at some point we have to accept the reality of their unwillingness to act and think about ways to stop Trump without them. Susan says, as in today's discussion of immigration relating to Brexit, it is often pointed out that we need immigration to offset the declining birth rates in Europe, Japan, and the U.S. I am supportive of immigration, but I am concerned that reduction in population that was once hailed as a major achievement in the fight to save the planet now is seen as something that must be compensated for through immigration. And finally, we got this from John and said, dear panel, I would think that Trump prefers unilateral trade deals versus multilateral, just like any employer prefers to deal one-on-one with employees than a union, divide and conquer. All right. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. So let's talk about Devin Nunes for a moment. Devin Nunes sued an obscure Twitter account. Now, Devin Nunes's cow has more followers than Devin Nunes. Please explain, Jim Hendler.
So while we've been on the air, I want you to know that Devin's cow has gotten 6,000 more followers in this past hour and a quarter.
Tell people how they can follow.
So, yeah. We will get there. But, okay, so
Jim, you utter.
No, wait. I think we have some cow jokes queued up, but I'm going to let me tell this story first.
Go ahead. Sure.
Yeah. So Devin Nunes, not always Congress's brightest light bulb, has decided he was going to sue Twitter because people on Twitter have been making fun of him. And two accounts named, among others, the company itself, is one called Devin Nunes' Mom, and another one is called Devin Nunes' Cow. At the time he made the announcement, the cow had about 1,000 followers, and Devin Nunes had about 380,000 followers. Okay. At the moment, the cow has 570,000 followers in 2 days, just showing the power of Twitter to have a sense of humor when something like this happens. And this account is brilliant and humorous, and I'll
This is a particularly moving story for us to take
there
on.
There we go.
And a lot of what Nunes has said is bull. This idea of trying to sue Twitter.
You beat me to it.
Yeah, but let me take the cream off the top then for you. You know, what this does do, and this is utterly ridiculous, I know, but what this does do, though, is that it keeps Devin in the spotlight with the president. Yep. And even though we think this is frivolous, it allows him to stay on the radar and keeps him in the running for a second-term appointment. Yep. So actually, when you're looking at this saying, this is horrible, this is stupid, this is, why are you even following it? This is a real example of how folks in the Trumpian world try to remain on his radar screen for future positions.
What are the merits of the suit in the sense of he's asking for $250 million in damages and to unmask the identity of the users behind Devin Cow and Devin Nunes's Mom?
So there's a big part of this that gets down to social media and things like that. The right wing feels that social media is somehow against them. And yet all the studies that have done show that they manipulate social media very, very effectively. They take it seriously. And I won't go into the math, but there's lots of ways to prove this.
We thank you.
So a big part of, you know, what you see in the Fox world is attacks on, you know, the president tweeting, and that's wonderful, but all this other stuff is bad. And shouldn't be there and making fun of people. They close down right-wing attacks when they get right-wing accounts when they get too far right. They do the same thing on the left. You just don't hear about it as much. So the social media companies have a real challenge here between freedom of speech and hate speech. And the right wing exploits that tremendously. I'm really talking now the far right. But the Trump camp has used this very, very effectively. So Nunes attacking Twitter is kind of attacking an enemy of that camp. So he's really trying, as you say, to keep himself in the spotlight. Other things it keeps things away from. So Nunes has a dairy. So the reason the cow came along is Nunes has a dairy company. It's called Nunes and Sons Incorporated. Makes over $1 million in revenue each year and gets big government subsidies beyond that, right? I'm sure we have dairy farmers who are listening to this who are stunned at that number. So this, you know, again, so this is a case where Nunes is putting himself in the spotlight, is taking on an enemy, is, you know, trying to manipulate. I think you're right. He wants to be appointed somewhere. And, you know, it just shows – it's just another example of what our country's coming to. What I do though, is that it was responded to with humor as well as with
– Well, it's that's terrific. But, yeah, you know, Nunes has proven himself to be a total tool the president. I mean, we remember him running up to the White House with information, supposedly secret information,
and acting
as
an
errand boy. Yeah, that's right, going through the bushes. And as of today, you've gotten me so angry about him, I'm willing to put him up there temporarily, just for the day. Honorifically, as one of the three worst people in America.
Yeah, all right.
A sliding scale, of course.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we have to remember he was the chair of this Select Committee on Intelligence, right? And he was responsible for a range of unnecessary hearings and blocking important information. Interesting about the farm, though, I learned yesterday when reading it. So Devin Nunes is from California. He's a congressman from California. And from a long history of dairy farming. But his farm was moved to Iowa a few years ago. And he has not talked about that publicly. And he does interviews on a farm, but it happens to not be his farm. So it's only recently been disclosed. But again, this brings us back to why does it matter in people's lives? And you think of, agriculture in this country is really suffering right now. And as you talk about the difference between who gets the money, big ag or family farmers and such. But if you haven't checked out this Devin Nunes Cow Twitter site, please do. It's hysterical.
But if everybody starts to sue for
Devin Cow.
But if everyone starts to sue over every yo mama joke or any insult that's ever been put, it's going to tie our court system.
But if you think about, how ironic. He is one of the biggest defenders of Donald Trump, and Donald Trump is one of the biggest bulliers on Twitter.
That irony is not lost in this.
And so of course, the Trumps really believe in suing. Yep. Remember, they gave advice to Theresa May to sue the European Union. Yep. This seems to be a pattern. Whenever you don't have an answer for anything, you just sue.
So I will say that when it comes to the merit of the suit, Alan Dershowitz, who is not exactly your liberal said he was asked about the suit and said he wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole. It has no merit in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah, but
Giuliani's
so
really
already signed up for it, though.
The one thing I wonder, and I haven't checked this, when he first announced it, it had not yet been filed. It didn't have a file number or anything. So, the ultimate frivolous suit is that you announce you're going to sue and then don't actually file. So it hadn't even been filed.
Well, he announced on Fox it was the first of many, many.
Yes, he did. He did say that to Sean Hannity. Real quick, we have just about 2 or 3 minutes left. I want to get to the Defense Department's Inspector General said on Wednesday that it was investigating complaints that the acting Defense Secretary, Patrick Shanahan, had been promoting his former employer, Boeing, and disparaging its military contractor competitors. The investigation will examine complaints filed last week by a watchdog group, Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, A spokesman for the Inspector General's office said that investigators had informed Mr. Shanahan of the inquiry. Mr. Shanahan told lawmakers last week that he supported an investigation. The investigation complicates what is already an uphill battle for Mr. Shanahan's effort to become the next permanent defense secretary. As recently as last week, Defense Department officials believed that President Trump was about to formally nominate Mr. Shanahan for the job left vacant by Jim Mattis, who resigned in December. But as Mr. Shanahan's troubles mount, the White House does not appear to have a ready and able alternative to him.
So I actually like the cow story better than this because it felt a little bit cleaner. This goes back, and I'll remind our listeners that Boeing has a long and troubled history with the Department of Defense in illegal activities. And I say that specifically when you're starting to talk about things like the Air Force tanker contracts with the idea of their hiring practices and recruitment practices. What's troubling me about the relationship between the acting Secretary of Defense is his unusually close tie to the military-industrial complex, in that we don't have someone at the top of the Department of Defense that's actually looking out necessarily for the best interests of the military and the country. And this is why I had a lot of faith in Mattis when he was secretary. I have much less faith in where we are right now. But there's a history here with Boeing that cannot be ignored. And when you start to talk about the amount of money that defense has and is putting into acquisitions, it dwarfs everybody else in the federal government, and it's real, real money.
The other thing that it reminded me of was that after the Ethiopia airline crash, the Ethiopian government handed over black box information to France for analysis and not the U.S. because they were deeply concerned about some of those close ties between the administration and Boeing and maybe not getting the full story. In addition to that, we have this really close relationship between the FAA and Boeing, and there are some things to worry about. Now, these ripple effects, of course, are likely going to affect our economic situation in this country, our growth rates. If Boeing, in fact, is put on hold, the sale of this MAX jetliner is put on hold, we will see a drop in our gross domestic product. I mean, these are very serious questions for us and our economic viability, and the closeness that you just talked about between Shanahan and Boeing and government transportation officials is deeply worrying, in my view.
We are.
You know, we heard.
We're out of time, Alan, but go ahead. We only have about 10 seconds.
I was going to say, we heard a great deal about too big to fail with the banks.
Right.
And I think Boeing fits into that, too. There are a lot of people who sell airplanes besides Boeing. There's Airbus, and that's it, I guess.
My thanks to everybody on the panel this morning. Thank you so much. Alan, be safe. Have a beautiful rest of your day in New Orleans, and we'll talk to you tomorrow. Thank you all. We'll be right back.